When I first gazed into the waters of the Colorado River in 1957, I had no idea how much history I was looking at. I was a youngster hitchhiking across America on Route 66, and I'd stopped in Needles, California to look out over the strange rock formations that gave Needles its name. Earlier this year, nearly 44 years later, I took a boat ride on the Colorado River from Needles down through the Topaz Gorge to Lake Havasu. I was traveling the length and breadth of the Colorado River watershed on one of my greatest adventures, interviewing folks as I went, trying to find out what people knew and had to say about the Colorado River system. Only when our boat cruised the surface of Lake Havasu did I actually see the very point where there is a pumping station on the west side of the lake that pumps billions and billions of gallons to Los Angeles and 25 other cities in Southern California, and a pumping station on the east side where billions of gallons more are pumped to Phoenix and Tucson. Without Lake Havasu, the coastal cities of California and the inland desert cities of central Arizona would be left high and dry. 100 years ago, there was no controlling system of ideas and laws that determined how to use the waters of the Colorado River. There were no dams and lakes on the river. The river ran wild. On the following program, we're going to explore some of the thinking and attitudes that resulted in the law of the river and set the stage for a period of construction of enormous dams behind which deep and long lakes now store water for 25 million of us who are tied to the river for our survival. My name is Jack Leffler, and I'm inviting you to join me as we explore part two of Moving Waters, the Colorado River and the West. The attitudes that shape America's ideas about conservation have changed over time. It's important to understand those attitudes because they eventually became codified in law. William DeBuis recently wrote a wonderful book entitled Salt Dreams. He told me about the mindset that prevailed a century ago when the Colorado River still ran wild and farmers needed a reliable source of water.
Well, I think, you know, that 1922 meeting up the road here at Bishop's Lodge was held really at the apogee of the ethic that the historian Sam P. Hayes has called the gospel of efficiency. And this was part of the conservation movement, really, this idea that, by God, nature was kind of sloppy. And if we were going to get the land and the waters to support as much of American society as we could, we had to be efficient, and we had to actually improve nature and make it more efficient. We were then looking at nature as though it were simply a machine, and the first step to make a machine more efficient was to remove surplus parts. And one of those surplus parts was floods. We had to get rid of that. That was wasteful. Another surplus part was letting fresh water get to the sea. And we were going to use everything, put everything to work, everything to use to make the most of this society we could. And so that Colorado River Compact divided up the waters of the river, and it sort of implicitly told the states, by God, you better get on with developing your share because somebody else is hungrier than you, and that's California, really. And you better get your share and develop it. The premise was to make that river work and make every drop in it work for the benefit of society. There wasn't the least glimmer of a thought that, well, maybe the river, which makes possible our life in this arid country, the river that is the linear oasis along which we live, that the river deserved any of its own water.
In Boulder City, Nevada, I visited with Dennis McBride. He spoke to me of the connection between flooding, the creation of the Salton Sea, and the construction of Boulder Dam. Dennis is an authority on the history of the lower Colorado River.
There was an effort in the early part of the century, 1904, 1905, 1906, to irrigate the Imperial Valley of California with water from the Colorado River. And they actually dug another channel to try to divert some of the Colorado out into the Imperial Valley, which was very important agricultural area at the time. Well, unfortunately, the river got away from them, and it actually jumped its original bed, original at the time, because it's changed beds many times, and started flowing through the channel that they had dug, and then, of course, dug a whole new channel right into the Imperial Valley and started filling up the north end of it which became the Salton Sea. And it took them a couple of years to get the river back under control again. And that was one of the great motivations for trying to find somewhere to build a dam on the Colorado, was to control the flooding. Because when the flooding would come down, the river would jump its bank and carve a new channel. So flooding was a terrible problem, and they had to get that under control. One of their little ancillary projects was explore the Colorado River and maybe see where we might could build a dam. And there were explorations on the river looking for a dam site through into the early 1920s until they finally narrowed it down to two, Boulder Canyon and Black Canyon, and ultimately changed it from Boulder Canyon, where they were actually going to start building, to Black Canyon.
It would require legislation to divide the waters between the seven states within the Colorado River Basin before any dams could be built. In 1922, Herbert Hoover presided over a meeting in Santa Fe, New Mexico, that resulted in the 1922 Colorado River Compact. The river was divided into two basins, with a dividing point at Lee's Ferry. The upper basin states of Colorado, Wyoming, Utah, and New Mexico apportioned the water amongst themselves. The lower basin states of California, Arizona, and Nevada required help from Congress. Arizona refused to sign the compact for two decades. Former Secretary of the Interior Stuart Udall, a native Arizonan, told me how unique the laws are that control the flow of water in the Colorado River.
The Santa Fe Compact simply divided waters and produced an interstate agreement, although Arizona refused to participate, and they fought it for 20 years because they saw it as California getting the upper hand and dominating the river. They were correct, in my opinion, in that assumption. But they had to have a law, and that became the Boulder Canyon Project, which would spell out what was going to happen if this big dam was built. And that was the beginning, really, of what they now later call, this was a lawyer's dream, the law of the river. And lawyers in all these states had to become acquainted with the law, and then additional laws were written, and there's a body of law called the law of the river. This is not true in any other river basin in the United States. To this degree, law governs everything.
Many people who analyze the relative strengths of different states think that California had the most influence and therefore got the best deal with the 1922 Compact. Floyd Dominey served as commissioner for the Bureau of Reclamation during the great period of dam building in the mid-20th century. He disagrees.
As a matter of fact, I'm kind of surprised that the Compact doesn't favor California more than it does. When you stop and think that at the time that Compact was drafted in the 20s, there were 13 congressmen from California and Arizona and Nevada. There were only 8 in the 4 upper basin states. So the population already favored California, and the influence in Congress already favored California. I'm kind of surprised that it came out the way it did. Now, the reason it did, because California wanted Hoover Dam, and they wanted the All-American Canal. They had to have some support from the rest of the West in order to get that. I think, actually, it turned out quite favorably for the upper basin states and Arizona compared to what could have been.
Patricia Mulroy is the general manager of the Southern Nevada Water Authority. In 1922, Las Vegas was a tiny community built near springs in the desert. There was no human population to speak of, so Nevada's apportionment is very small compared to those of California and Arizona. Still, Patricia Mulroy contends that the compact provides a rigid framework within which there is plenty of room to maneuver.
In my mind, the law of the river was put into place to prevent any one partner on that river system from being able to get the upper hand on the rest of them. But the law of the river is flexible enough that it allows the states, if in agreement, to do anything they want to do. There are no omnibus barriers. There are no barriers that are so rigid and so impenetrable that you can't get through them. And they allow common sense and productive partnerships to work.
Water rights attorney Bill Swan interprets the law of the river based on his understanding of the history of river development. He reckons that California did very well in Santa Fe in 1922.
The California guys got what they wanted. That is, they got a big dam, they got a controlled river, they got a diversion structure, they got what they wanted. And so the California people got going lickety-split to develop their contracts. The 1929 Act provided that they had to have contracts with the secretary to use this river water, even if they had developed prior rights. And of course, the Congress recognized that some people had already appropriated water and went to great lengths to protect those prior rights, which they called present perfected rights, on both sides of the river down there. They got these contracts in place among the big California users. Who are those users? Imperial Irrigation District, Coachella Valley Water District, Palo Verde Irrigation District, and of course the big giant Metropolitan Water District of Southern California, which also eventually served San Diego.
The Reclamation Act of 1902 was intended to help family farmers and ranchers succeed in the arid landscapes of the West. Today, over 80% of California's allocation of Colorado River water goes to agriculture, which is a direct outgrowth of farmers gaining earliest rights to the river. Former Secretary of the Interior Bruce Babbitt spoke to me about the original intent of reclaiming the West.
The original philosophy of all of the great big government reclamation projects was sort of an aquatic version of the Homestead Act. The whole idea was to put small people on the land through reclamation. It never really happened in most of the West. I don't think it ever is going to happen. Sort of transition to large-scale agriculture is a fact. It's not what was intended, but it's there, and it's not going to change.
While the intent of the Reclamation Act had small farmers in mind, the country didn't really have a good appreciation of the fluctuating waters of the Colorado. Folklorist Hal Cannon points out that there can be a vast difference between wet years and dry years.
If you've lived in a place that you see the effect of the years that there's a lot of water and the years that there's not much water, the difference between those years when tons of water is falling out of the canyons in springtime and those when the snowpack hasn't been very much is so extreme, and the drama between those two amounts is so extreme, that it's hard to believe that you can assume that it's always going to be a constant to just turn on your tap, because nature just don't work that way.
How could we know how much water to allocate if we didn't know how much water would flow in any given year? Historian Norris Hundley wrote the book, as they say, on the Colorado River, including one entitled The Great Thirst. When I visited him in Santa Barbara, Norris mentioned a serious miscalculation that became a major factor in determining the allocations between the upper and lower basins of the Colorado River.
The river flow assumptions were in error. Some of this became known as early as the 20s in the debates over the Boulder Canyon project. There was a Colorado River Board created for that project, and the folks there went out, consulted some of the more recent measurements, and felt that there was nowhere near 17 or 18 million, maybe 15 million. Additional measurements were made and so forth. And finally, they determined that based on the evidence they had, there would be no more than about 14 million acre feet in the river, at best, on an average. Remember, their basic allocation was 16. 1.5 million went to Mexico as a priority. Mexico's right was vested in a treaty, and a treaty has all the clout of the Constitution. You can't violate a treaty without probably going to war with Congress and Mexico eventually. It has first priority. But like most new knowledge that you don't want to hear, you don't want to believe, it took a long time for this shock to make itself really felt. So many of these people in the basin were in shock. Many still believe that the upper basin would never use its full allocation. Somehow, science would bail them out.
Jim Nafsi is an engineer employed by the Metropolitan Water District, which serves the coastal cities of California. Jim is also a history buff and provided me with a fascinating glimpse into the mindset that led to construction of the Hoover Dam, which resulted in Lake Mead, and Parker Dam, which resulted in Lake Havasu.
In the early 1900s, here we had this wild, untamable river that didn't have any dams on it. In the springtime, when we had the snow melt, it would wash out farms, crops, cattle, anything that got in its way. And in drought situations, there are places you could walk across the river. And we had these thousands of men come into the area and actually start building two major dam projects on the river that were pretty much being built concurrently. The first, as we know, was the Boulder Dam. And the second one was little old Parker Dam right over here that the Metropolitan Water District actually sponsored about 95% of the cost of to construct this dam. And this dam's purpose was to create a forebay of water to pump from for the Colorado River Aqueduct. Now, when we look back, we couldn't pump from this river that would run raging in the springtime and almost dry out in the wintertime. So we needed to dam that water up to have a forebay of water to pump from.
Dennis McBride recounted lore that he had gathered about some of the movers and shakers whose perseverance resulted in construction of both Hoover and Parker dams.
Frank Crow probably is the one most responsible for bringing the six companies together, the constituent companies, into the organization called Six Companies, which built the dam. But he was up and down the Colorado River as early as the early part of the 20th century. And he always said, and I have this from people I interviewed who knew him and whose parents knew him, that he was going to build a dam on the Colorado River. So he was involved over two, almost three decades before they started construction on the dam. And over those years, say 1902, when the Reclamation Service was founded, up to 1928, when they signed the Boulder Canyon Project Act, when Coolidge signed it, Crow gathered kind of a core group of construction workers that followed him from job to job and ultimately followed him out here to Hoover Dam.
Parker Dam created Lake Havasu, the reservoir from which water is now pumped by the Metropolitan Water District to the coastal cities of California. Jim Nafsi recounts a story from the days of the dam's construction that reveals the intensity of the rivalry between Arizona and California to control the river.
But you know, back in 1934, I think it was, Arizona didn't want any part of the Parker Dam. In fact, the governor was Governor Moore at the time, and he decided that he was not going to let any Californians tell him what to do. He decided to send out about half a dozen National Guardsmen to stop the Metropolitan Water District from the construction of the Parker Dam. So they came over to Parker from Phoenix and met up with Nellie Bush and Parker, and they got on the Julia B, which was one of Nellie's ferry boats that she ran up and down the river, and she brought them up the river as far as she could, as close as she could, to the construction site for the Parker Dam, and let these National Guardsmen off. They had a three-day trek up to what is called Takeoff Point, where they actually set up camp, and they were going to stop the surveyors for the Metropolitan Water District from rowing across the river and doing the survey work required to lay out for the Parker Dam. Well, little did they know, as they went through our hot summers where temperatures get up to 128 degrees, that they couldn't find any water to drink. They thought they could actually drink the water from the river, this muddy brown river that people used to say, this river is too thick to drink and too thin to plow. It would take over 2 days for it to settle out a glass of water so you can get a little bit of water to drink. And these poor guys are out there in the heat, didn't have enough water, didn't have enough food. The surveyors from Metropolitan actually felt sorry for them, so they would give them food and sandwiches and water, and they'd be rowing across the river, and, hey, guys, how you doing and having a good time? Got to know each other fairly well. One day, Governor Moore really decided that it was time to stop the Metropolitan Water District, so he really came down on National Guardsmen. They were building up the troops by then. I think at one time they said they had almost 100 National Guardsmen here. So one day, as the story goes, that they're rowing across the river, and they pop up from their side, and the National Guardsmen pop up from their side of the river, and they fire a couple of shots across the bow of their rowboat. You Californians, get on back to your side. Us Arizonans don't need any part of that dam. You're not going to tell us what to do. Well, I actually started one of the longest legal battles in the history of the United States, Arizona v. California, and it was all over water rights. And to this day, really, water rights is still key to growth of communities, but it really is a required commodity for growth and for the health of all communities. So a reliable source of water is imperative. And that's what the Metropolitan Water District is most concerned with, is to be in a reliable source of water to the coastal plains of Southern California.
The men who came to work as high scalers, they had no experience. They were just men who were hungry enough that they would hang 700 feet above the bottom of the canyon on a little bosun's chair tied to a steel knocked in the ground another 100 feet above them on a rope. and they swung back and forth. They became very agile, of course, through experience in swinging out from here to there and prying the rock off and drilling the holes for blasting and so on. But, you know, it didn't actually take any particular skill, just the ability not to have acrophobia and the ability to hang on to this rope. Yeah, one gentleman that I interviewed, Joe Kine, who actually has a monument now raised to him down at the dam. They dragged a big rock down there to the visitor center, and Steve Liguori, who's a local artist, made a life-size bronze, larger than life-size bronze, of Joe Kine the high scaler. Joe said it was the best job on the project because it was a sitting-down job. Yeah, there is one very famous story, it's well known, where someone had fallen off the cliffs and one of the high scalers swung out on his rope and caught this man before he plunged all the way down to the bottom and died. The high scaler himself who swung out actually got an award from some company that manufactured watches, so he became their endorsement. And that story also found its way into Zane Grey's novel about construction of the dam called Boulder Dam.
Floyd Dominey still remembers how he felt when he first saw Hoover Dam.
I saw Hoover Dam for the first time on January 2nd, 1937, and I marveled that any outfit could have the know-how and the vision to construct something like that. It just was a magnificent thing, as big as the pyramids, as beautiful as the Taj Mahal. But these, of course, were monuments to the dead, and Hoover Dam was a monument to the living.
I've toured Hoover Dam, and I agree with Floyd Dominey that it is indeed one of the great engineering marvels of all time. Gary Bryant is responsible for day-to-day managing of the Hoover Dam. He gave me an idea of the magnitude of the structure.
If you come and look at the dam, it's kind of deceiving, but at the base of it, the part that's down by bedrock, is probably from the top to the bottom, it's about 700 feet. But it's also that wide at the bottom. It's almost as wide as it is tall. Now, when you look at it, the very top of it's only 45 feet, but it goes down into this triangular pattern, so that it's really quite wide. The water behind it's backed up. Right behind the dam is about 500 feet deep, so it's quite a deep dam and quite a deep reservoir.
It wasn't until 1944 that the United States actually got around to working out a treaty with Mexico over how much water Mexico could count on from the Colorado River. Stuart Udall was serving in the United States military at the time.
The history of the 1944 treaty with Mexico was during the war, 1944, and obviously was an effort by President Roosevelt to mollify the Mexican officials. They had the agriculture south of the Imperial Valley in Baja California. It was a rich agricultural area, and they wanted to protect their water. And they said, you divided up the river, but you left us out. And so this treaty guaranteed Mexico a certain amount of water, and that was the 1944 U.S.-Mexico treaty. It wasn't a treaty with the states. It was the United States of America and the government of Mexico.
When I visited with Bruce Babbitt in Washington, D.C., he reminded me that water and power generation are interlinked. Indeed, many of the great dams generate enormous amounts of hydroelectric power.
The reclamation movement, the building of dams, never really was a very big enterprise in the West until Thomas Edison came along and invented uses for electricity. That just set off a cataract of demand because people began to understand that hydroelectric power, then really the principal source of power, was very valuable. It's just set off a rush of dam building because dams are viewed as cash registers. You build a dam and you get a cascade of money coming out of them through the electrical generators. And I suspect more than anything, it was the demand for hydropower that led to this lamentable kind of a dam on every river in the West. But now what's happening is the curves are crossing because when they first started building dams, water was valuable, but not nearly as much in demand as electricity. Now, those curves are going to cross, and the day's coming when the water will be vastly more valuable than the electricity it generates, and those dams won't look nearly as interesting because of all the tremendous losses through evaporation from the reservoirs.
Historian Patty Limerick provided me with an overview of the history of the Department of the Interior and the enormous responsibility that is delegated through its various bureaus.
Department of Interior is formed in 1849 as a real recognition that the United States has an empire. The United States was cast with a self-image. We are the colony that revolted against the empire, and now we are independent. But by 1849, it was perfectly clear that the United States had a contiguous land empire. You can't have an empire casually. Empire is not something that you attend to every few years. You really do have to rule an empire. So Interior, I think, really represents that. And then as conservation movement gets going and as new designations of lands and permanent public ownership come in, that moves into the sort of the home office for ruling that Western Empire. So all the agencies, Bureau of Indian Affairs, obviously, and Bureau of Reclamation, National Park Service, what began as the Grazing Service and became Bureau of Land Management, anomalously National Forest Service and Agriculture, not Interior, although I mean, Harold Ickes in the 30s was still trying really hard to get the Forest Service back over to Interior. So it turns out that there's this really remarkable consolidated power over Western destinies in this thing called the Department of the Interior.
Lori Gray is the Assistant Director for the Lower Colorado region of the Bureau of Reclamation. When I visited her in her Boulder City office, she gave me some perspective regarding the role of the Bureau of Reclamation in managing the waters of the Lower Colorado.
Primarily in the Lower Colorado region from Lee's Ferry down to the Mexican border, we manage the river on behalf of the Secretary. The Secretary has been deemed the water master through a Supreme Court ruling, and so we manage the river, we look after contracts, pay attention to who's using what amount of water, try to provide habitat for species that will allow us to continue to manage the river. And then we have some facilities on the river, Hoover Dam, Davis Dam, Parker Dam, and we actually manage those three facilities, which are all power-producing facilities.
The law of the river is a complex of laws that reflect the changing interests of those who compete for the opportunity to tap into the aquatic lifeline of much of the West to serve all of us who now turn on a faucet and fill our glasses with water that began its journey to our homes from the Colorado River system. Bruce Babbitt shared a poignant thought to reflect on.
When the environmental movement in this country really grew up at the turn of the century, this was Teddy Roosevelt, Gifford Pinchot, all of the great pioneers, they were looking at the land and the forests. The water kind of escaped their attention. And remarkably enough, the interest in water and its ecological function on the landscape never really got moving until the 1960s, 70s, and 80s. And the difficulty is that by then we'd had a century of these water development projects which had no ecological analysis or component to them at all. But when Glen Canyon Dam was built, nobody even asked the questions, what will this do downstream on the Colorado River in terms of the native fish species, in terms of the beaches along the Grand Canyon? For whatever reason, we were very late coming to the issue of water and how it sustains and nourishes the creation and the beauty and diversity of the landscape.
Moving Waters, the Colorado River in the West, is a production of the Arizona Humanities Council. Executive Director Dan Schilling. Our series is presented by the Humanities Councils and Endowments of Arizona, California, Colorado, Nevada, New Mexico, Utah, and Wyoming. Funding was provided by the Ford Foundation and the National Endowment for the Humanities. The project director is Nancy Dallette. The executive producer is Marcos Martinez. Our production assistant is Celestia Peregrina Leffler. Our theme was performed by Carl Bernstein. The series was produced in its entirety by Jack Leffler in Santa Fe, New Mexico. For Moving Waters, the Colorado River in the West, thank you for listening.